Welcome to Blocked and Reported. I'm Katie Herzog, and while my co-host Jesse is trying to get someone, anyone, to publish his magnum opus on the ideological bias at Blocked and Reported, today we have Billy Binion. Billy is a writer and editor at Reason Magazine, where he covers criminal justice and government accountability. Billy, welcome to Blocked and Reported.
Thank you so much for having me. So I just want to start by giving a shout out to my sister, Molly Eisenbach, who happens—
Hello, Molly.
Yes, she happens to be a huge fan of the show, as well as my niece, Olivia, who probably, and I mean this literally, has been listening since she was in the womb. She's over the ripe old age of three, so she's, I don't think, ever lived a life.
I've been grooming her through the airwaves.
Yeah, I don't think she's ever lived life without Blocked and Reported in the background.
Wow. Okay, well, hello to your sister, Molly. She sent me an email recently, and she had several corrections for me having to do with our recent episode on Candace Owens. That was a primo episode, so we won't get into it here. But Molly, I am looking at your corrections. I will do something with your corrections. There will be corrections coming.
Wow. She's having an influence.
She is. She's our external editor. All right. We have a great show today. Later, we're going to be discussing Man of God, Steven Crowder. But before we get to that, Billy, let's talk about you. So you are a libertarian. I assume that you've got an AK-47 in one hand and a mango vape in the other. You're also young, or at least baby face. I did dream last night that you were 50. Very strange dream. In my dream, I was like, I said something about you being young and you said, actually, I'm 50. And I was like, damn, you look fantastic.
I'm just happy to be in your dreams.
It's very strange. I have never dreamt about Jesse. You, first time talking to you, already dreamed about you.
Right.
I'm assuming that you being a young libertarian puts you in a minority among your peers. So how did you come to libertarianism?
Well, I just want to say at the outset that I'm more of a watermelon girl as opposed to a mango vape girl.
I thought you were talking about Palestine for a second.
Oh, no, no. That's too charged for this. And I usually call it my disco stick. But other than that, so my ideological journey was kind of weird. I guess in college, I was always one of those people who had the like kind of obnoxious, like socially liberal, fiscally conservative, like very oversimplified version of libertarianism. I grew up in a pretty conservative family. And so some of it always made sense to me. Like I never understood, you know, spending lots of money that you don't have, as the government tends to do. And both parties tend to do. They just like to spend it on different things.
I also tend to do that.
Honestly, same. But the ideas of freedom and liberty always resonated with me, but I always kind of felt like neither party like upheld those principles consistently until I stumbled onto libertarianism. And it was I was looking for journalism fellowships and found a fellowship that essentially outlined everything they stood for. It was, you know, free speech, curbing law enforcement misconduct, pulling back crony capitalism, which is, you know, when the government gives subsidies to their preferred companies, you know, not ratcheting up government spending. So America is buckling under trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. And then also like applying those principles of freedom and liberty to things like the immigration system and the criminal justice system. I never really understood, for instance, why Republicans, they talk a lot about liberty, but then some of them are super restrictionist on things like immigration, which just doesn't make sense to me. If you don't trust the federal government, why do you trust the federal government to like arbitrarily pick immigration levels or to like over-criminalize like silly things? To me, it was the political philosophy that I felt was most consistent, and that was important to me.
Was that fellowship with Reason?
It was not. I feel like some of your listeners will immediately tune me out, but it was with the Koch Foundation, and I didn't know who they were at the time.
Hey, they fund NPR too. They fund PBS.
Right. I mean, it's the David Koch Theater in New York City for the New York City Ballet. Right. So they basically throw money at many different things. And at the time, I actually didn't know who they were. I was a young 25-year-old who just read what they stood for, which, like I said, was things like free speech, playing about crony capitalism, curbing law enforcement conduct, not over-criminalizing dumb victimless crimes. And I was like, wow, I finally feel like something is, you know, checking off all the boxes on my list that I've been trying to kind of vocalize, but didn't have a place to do so. Because, I mean, as you know, our politics have always been very binary. And a better way to put it is I feel very politically homeless, even to this day. I would not say I'm definitely not active in the Libertarian Party. It's just more of the classical liberal philosophy that most resonates with my values.
Okay, well, let's get to the party. So I vaguely follow libertarian politics purely because that party is messy as hell, and I love drama. Can you explain what the hell is going on with the Libertarian Party?
Sure. So a couple of years ago, there was essentially a tug of war between two different factions within the Libertarian Party. One was kind of like the old guard, which is that classical liberal, I would argue the more sane version. Classical liberal, I mean, is kind of like, you know, the old version of liberalism espoused by the founders of this country. And then the second faction is usually called the Mises Caucus, which is harder right. I think they refer to themselves as paleo-libertarians.
It's the fedora wing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they're really just defined, honestly, by culture war, culture warring. They lean super hard into, like, trans issue. I mean, like, being very vocally right wing on things that I think traditionally libertarians would just say, like, okay, that's not a decision that I feel comfortable with, but if you want to make a bad decision, you do you. That is the libertarian philosophy, supposedly, right? Is you do you. Mm-hmm. But the Mises Caucus has kind of like really leaned hard into the, you know, culture war battles. It's not very policy driven. One of the reasons I love working at Reason is because we write about policy, and I think policy is what most Americans care about. They don't care about, you know, I think few people care about things like Drag Queen Story Hour, or if they do, they care more, at least, about how to feed their families. And anyway, all this to say, in this tug of war, the Mises Caucus, that kind of section of the party, currently is, you know, controlling the party. It won, and it's, I would describe it as essentially just a bunch of internet edgelords who care less about winning elections or even promoting the political philosophy of libertarianism or classical liberalism, and more about getting attention on the internet.
Yeah, the Mises Caucus is probably best embodied by the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire Twitter feed. Have you followed this?
Oh, yeah, that's 100%. The guy who's, I mean, it's just like, really, really strident contrarianism, almost always about culture war stuff, not really talking about policy. I mean, a good example would be that the chair of the Libertarian Party did an interview, I think, on The Hill, and it was after RFK Jr. picked his running mate, who is not anywhere near libertarian, and she was just like, we're all so confused. And it's just, like, massively silly because RFK Jr. over the entire course of his career, including his presidential campaign, has advocated for expanding the federal government in enormous ways. I mean,
yeah, you know, including when it comes to things like speech.
Yeah. I mean, he this is the person who at one point floated jailing people who weren't sufficiently vocal about climate change, or people who were climate deniers. I mean,
yeah.
But that kind of gets to what I'm saying, which is that they liked him because he spoke out against lockdowns and has a cult following. Mm-hmm. And that's really the only two. They talk about one policy thing. They talk about lockdowns. Okay, I think the way governments handled, you know, state and local governments handled COVID was awful. So I empathize, but like, there's more to the policy than just that. And also, COVID is basically over. So like, we should be looking at other policy discussions. But yeah, she just said something like, you know, I'm just so confused, we're all so confused. And I responded to her and was like, it's not confusing, because he's not even kind of libertarian, has never claimed to be. If you read his policy positions, from, you know, mandating paid leave to quote unquote virtually free college to crony energy subsidy, I mean, it's like a checklist of things libertarians say they don't stand for. So, I mean, that's the kind of brand that the Libertarian Party is dealing with now. And like I said earlier, even before they took over, I've always just felt kind of politically homeless. I don't think every political party is kind of entrenched in some sort of nonsense. And I mean, I just feel like no one really speaks for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be interested, where do you feel like you fall in the political spectrum these days?
I'm a registered Democrat. I'm open to voting for Republicans or third party candidates if one speaks to me, but I really do vote on policy more than culture wars. Like right now in Washington, there's a race between a very progressive Democrat and a pretty conservative Republican. And to me, the like number one policy issue that I care about in Washington state is the ferry system, because this affects me very deeply. I live in a ferry community, and that's the one thing that I really give a shit about. So I will be casting my vote based on who promises to fix the failing ferry system and probably nothing else, which is probably going to be the Democrat. So I feel, you know, I feel disenchanted with party politics. I really wish that we didn't have a two-party system. However, every attempt to reform this, including more established third parties like the Libertarian Party or new attempts like No Labels seem pretty fruitless at this point. And the Libertarian Party, I find very amusing, but I would be hard pressed to vote for a member of that party at this point, especially as I watch what has gone down with the Mises caucus taking over. I'm not going to vote for the Libs of TikTok party, which is what the Libertarian Party has become in my mind.
I totally agree with you. I mean, the chair of the Libertarian Party, I hate to even give her more attention, but she like a year ago started like a makeup company that was like, I'm not going to use any male models, as if men wearing makeup is something like she felt threatened by some, you know, maybe like a Sephora campaign or something where there's like an effeminate man wearing makeup alongside female models. And I'm just like, what? Why do you care? Like, even if you think it's weird for a man to wear makeup, this has no effect on anyone.
It's an anti-libertarian position to give a fuck if a man is wearing makeup.
Exactly. And you can say culturally, like, that makes me uncomfortable, but the entire ethos is like, you know, it's why. I would give another example of like, you know, the debate over decriminalizing drugs. Mm-hmm. It's not because, you know, I think it's great to go and shoot up heroin. It's just you're looking at a cost benefit relationship of, you know, what are the trade offs? Mm-hmm. So all of that to say, I bring that up because, you know, the idea being that if someone is making a decision that you personally disagree with for, you know, whatever reason, a man wearing makeup bothers her, it has literally no impact on you. So I don't get why the chair of, you know, the only visible third party in the country is picking those battles. I find it deeply unserious.
Yeah. I mean, this is the problem with culture wars replacing policy positions.
Right. And your point about the third or needing more than two parties, I would love to see that, but I mean, I agree that the, you know, the party that is visible and aligns with my values, I don't even really support. Maybe I'll do a write-in candidate, you know, something like that, but I wonder if in our lifetime that'll be something that materializes. Probably not, right?
I mean, I think that the two parties are so entrenched they will never let that happen. Thankfully for you, you live in Texas and I live in Washington, so our votes don't matter anyway.
Exactly. I do feel that way.
Okay, let's talk about your work a bit. I am not sure there's any other Twitter feed that consistently makes me angry like your does. Maybe when Jesse posts his horrible food photos, that also makes me mad. But your Twitter threads and your work at Reason might be the thing that finally tips me, if anything did, into libertarianism or even anarchism, or it makes me the Joker, one of those. So let's talk about that. You've covered tons of really important stories, from SWAT teams destroying innocent people's homes and then refusing to cover the bill, to policies that literally put prosecutors above the law. But one of the stories that really struck with me is that of two women, one named Geraldine Tyler and the other Tawanda Hall. Tell us about them.
Right. So Geraldine Tyler, she is a woman in her mid-90s, and she had a Minneapolis condo where she, you know, essentially she wanted to move out of this neighborhood because there were a couple of neighborhood incidents that made her feel unsafe. So she moved into a retirement home, and with the rent on her retirement home and the property tax on her condo, she ended up falling behind on that property tax and accruing a modest debt. I think it was $2,300. The local government tacked on about $13,000 in penalties, interest, and fees. So she owed $15,000. And then the government seized her condo, sold it for $40,000, and kept the profit. So, you know, Geraldine Tyler never contested that she owed the government that $15,000, even though the penalties, interest, and fees are insane. That's a whole, you know, other discussion.
Yeah.
But what she was basically saying is like, okay, so you seized my home over this modest property tax bill. You know, I'm in my mid-90s. And then you're going to keep the money in excess of what I actually owed. And then another victim over in Michigan, and this one is like even more nauseating. Her name is Tawanda Hall. She accrued a $900 tax debt. The government tacked on penalties, interest, and fees, and her total bill ended up being a little over $22,000.
That's it. I'm a libertarian now.
Right, and we're not even at the worst part. The penalties, interest, and fees, like I said, that is a legitimate constitutional discussion that I do think should happen, because that's insane.
Yeah, it's insane.
So her home was worth more than $300,000. The government seized it, sold it, and kept the profit, which was around $286,000.
Unbelievable.
Right. So essentially, this comes down to the takings clause of the Fifth Amendment. Whenever I was covering these stories, people were like, how is that even possible? The takings clause of the Fifth Amendment is supposed to ensure that the government cannot take private property without just compensation. And, you know, of course, a lot of constitutional lawyers were like, this is very much in opposition to that. But, you know, shockingly, a lot of courts were ruling against these victims.
Yeah. Okay. So this, which amounts to equity theft by the government, you write that this is legal in 12 states. And in some of those states, you write, the county treasurer will actually give the deed to investors who are then allowed to seize the home, sell it, and keep the proceeds. Unbelievable. And as you point out, this specifically targets vulnerable populations like the poor, the elderly, people who can't pay their property taxes, much less the astronomical penalties and interest for missing these payments.
Right. So I think a lot of people roll their eyes when I bring up that this affects vulnerable populations, but it is just that should just be an
obvious
right. It's just be an obvious truth, right? Because if you are really elderly, if you're disabled, or if you're like a caretaker, you are more likely to fall behind on those types of payments or to just simply miss that you owed them. So for in the third party scenario you outlined, there was a man in Nebraska. And so basically in Nebraska, what was happening is if someone fell behind on their property taxes, the government would secretly sell that property tax debt to a third party behind the person's back. Several years will go by, and then the private investor who bought this tax debt will send the owner a message and say, hey, you know, you have a few months to pay off this debt, which has ballooned over the course of this period where it just continued to grow. And if you can't satisfy this enormous debt that you couldn't satisfy even the modest amount, you know, years prior, then the local government will give over the deed to the private investor, and then they can just take your house. So the Supreme Court heard a case, heard Geraldine Tyler's case, actually, last summer, and ruled 9-0 in favor of her, which sounds like great news. But unfortunately, some states, as, you know, governments tend to do, are trying to get around that and pass laws that would allow governments and third parties to essentially skirt that ruling and take more than what is owed, take people's home equity, unless property owners go to court and fight for it back and file for that equity back within a very narrow window. So essentially, they're trying to set up these homeowners to fail. Mm-hmm. And like I said, the discussion in these cases was never that these people didn't owe their taxes. And that's another decision for or another discussion for another day, like how much should property tax be, that sort of thing. I'm not even trying to get into that. Geraldine Tyler, like I said, she said, I did owe the $2,300. I owe the $15,000 once you tackle all those penalties and fees. The only thing at issue here is should the government be able to keep the profit? And I think most sane people would say no.
Right. And do you think, so you said a moment ago that people sort of roll their eyes when you talk about how this impacts the most vulnerable. Do you think that's just sort of like an anti-woke reaction to terms like vulnerable people?
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I mean, I just think a lot of these discussions around, you know, policies disproportionately hurting poor people, disabled people, that kind of thing, have become so entrenched in the culture war. Yeah. But as I was saying earlier, I really like to write about policy, and it is just plainly true that a lot of policies like this from the government do naturally kind of prey on people who can't help themselves.
Right. And I think this is the sort of thing that everybody should care about. It has actually has nothing to do with race. This is really a class issue.
Absolutely.
So a story like this, which is about two black women in this case, they're going to maybe they just their brains turn off like, oh, this is a DEI story or whatever. No, it's not. It's actually not.
Exactly. And the Nebraska case I mentioned was a white man, and he was elderly and caring for his dying wife, and they were very poor. I mean, and these, you know, tragic life events, they just sometimes get in the way of, you know, you being able to support yourself. Another like horrific case I covered was one out in DC, and he was an elderly man who was suffering with dementia, and he fell behind on his tax. I don't remember the exact number, so I don't want to say the wrong thing, but it was even less than Geraldine. It was something like extremely minuscule. And the DC government seized his home and sold it. and he thought he'd been locked out because he had dementia, so he just for a long time slept on his porch. It's that's just, I mean, people can Google it. His name, I think, was Benny Coleman. But I mean, these are the kinds of stories that just, like you said, this is an everyone issue. You know, I know I write for a libertarian magazine, but when I'm writing about these things, I really am talking to everyone. I just think that whether you're on the left or the right, you may speak a different language about why it matters to you. Maybe if you, you know, are on the right, you think this is, you know, irresponsible, you know, government run amok. And then if you're on the left, maybe it's a social justice issue. But at the end of the day, we should all come to the same conclusion, which is that the government should not be able to steal from its own citizens.
Do you get accused of being woke because so many of the stories that you write about do include criticizing the criminal justice system?
Such an interesting question. I would say the funny thing about working for Reason is that everyone on the right thinks you're on the left and everyone on the left thinks you're on the right. That's really the complaint I get most often, is that, you know, I have a lot of really very principled friends on both sides who don't feel that way about me. But, you know, the kind of like online peanut gallery, I definitely get a lot from the right that, yeah, you're woke, whatever. And then on the left, you know, that I'm some sort of stodgy conservative, which is hysterical because by no stretch of the imagination am I either of those things. If you actually know me as a person and have read my stuff.
I mean, I think, again, that's an example of why culture wars makes everything dumber, because criminal justice reform and government accountability, these are things that impact everybody. These are things that everybody should care about.
Absolutely. I mean, like, if you want responsible government and efficient government, which is something that it should just not be a partisan thing, that's really what I'm talking about here. I think the problem, and I'm sure that you would agree with this, I know you've talked about it on your show, is that both sides are kind of held captive by just like the loudest, fringiest voices that speak for a really small sliver of people. And I think this is true of both the far right and the far left. And I know it's one of the reasons you like kind of like calling out a lot of this hypocrisy on your show, because they claim, or it seems like they're speaking for everyone because they get so much attention because they just hog the microphone. Mm-hmm. But like, they're not speaking for everyone. And a lot of people think what they're saying is absurd.
Yes. Yes, that's a good way to put it. Hog the mic from. Speaking of extremists, so I want to talk about one more thing before we get to Crowder. There have been a number of high-profile pro-Palestinian protests in recent days. Protesters shut down bridges in New York and San Francisco, as well as the main road to the airport in Seattle. Dozens of people have been arrested. Billy, what do you think about this sort of action? And as someone who covers criminal justice and policing, what do you think authorities should do about it?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question, because I feel like we're seeing more and more of these protests. I mean, obviously, you know, blocking traffic is not a new thing. But I think one of the things that has gotten lost in this is that, of course, protesting is a First Amendment right. Mm-hmm. But blocking traffic is a crime, and it is not protected by the First Amendment. So I know that, you know, there are a lot of people, especially on the far left in this case, that are really scandalized when police come and break up these protests. But the entire point of civil disobedience was that, you know, you were willing to break a law.
Exactly.
Right.
And pay the fucking punishment.
Yes, exactly. So if you think that the pro-Palestinian cause is, you know, so dire that you need to block people trying to get to the airport, and if you think that's a good way to further your point, okay. I'm often told, you know, the point of protesting is not to be, it's not convenience. And I understand that. But then it is not scandalous when you're arrested.
Right.
Because you broke the law. I mean,
letter from a Birmingham jail. The jail was the key part here. It wasn't letter from a Birmingham brunch. Like, right.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my take on it. I don't think it's a very good way to win adherence to your side. And like I said, that's when people always come back with, you know, that's not the point. The point is to inconvenience people, to kind of force their hand.
How is, like, making me late for work going to do anything about the fucking war in Gaza?
Did you see the one recently where they, I forget which airport it was. I mean, there have been a few airport blockades, but people were leaving their cars and just, like, taking their, or maybe they were jumping out of Ubers, but they were jumping out on the interstate and, like, rolling their suitcases on the interstate to try to walk to the airport. I think it was Chicago. To try to walk to the airport. And it's like, if you made me miss a flight, you know, talk about people, you know, who may not have a lot of money. I mean, not everyone can afford to miss a flight. Do you think that's like a standing up for like the little guy? I can't. That's where you lose me.
Right. I'm not generally in favor of police brutality, but I will make an exception for this. I want these people to be spanked. There are real consequences for people here, whether it's missed flights or missed work or people not getting to the hospital to say goodbye to their meemaw right. before she dies.
Yeah. I do not mean to interrupt.
No,
but the case I covered a case, one of these interstate protests that like still sticks with me to this day. It was summer of 2022. And there was a guy who was a truck driver in the DC metro area who ran into a climate protest. So this is, you know, wasn't even, I would think that the protesting the war between Israel and Hamas, you know, is actually something that I understand why people are very insistent about it, but people blocking the interstate because they wanted Biden to declare a climate emergency.
Right, making cars idle for climate change.
Right, right, exactly. The hypocrisy there is quite clear, but this guy gets out of his truck and is like, I'm on parole, mm-hmm. and if I miss work, I'm going to go back to jail. Right. And that shocks people because they're like, well, that just shows there's a problem with the parole system, to which I say yes, but all because, you know, people are thrown back in jail all the time for these really arbitrary violations, like being late for work, that kind of thing. But at the same time, it's also like, let this man, like, the left is supposed to stick up for people in these situations, like the people who are in the criminal justice system who are trying to get back on their feet. And you're really going to make this guy go back to jail?
Right. It is dangerous. I mean, this week, hospitals in San Francisco said organ transplants were delayed because of protests there. In Seattle a couple years ago, an ambulance transporting someone in critical condition was delayed during a protest against the war in Ethiopia, which now I know there's a war in Ethiopia. So I guess they did raise an awareness. But it makes me, all of this shit makes me so much less sympathetic to the cause, whatever the cause is, which doesn't actually matter because this sort of action doesn't change anything. It is especially idiotic when climate activists do it because they are contributing to climate change by making thousands of vehicles idle in place. But you know what? Good. I feel like at this point, when I see this shit, let the sea levels rise. If it kills them, it'll be worth it. I'm kind of kidding here, but I really hate this shit. I don't think I'm alone in this. I think this is the majority in position. So like Extinction Rebellion in the UK, they actually said last year that they're moving away from these disruptive tactics, probably because everyone hated them. But unfortunately, it's just growing in the US. I don't know. Like, if the idea is to bring awareness to the cause, wear a fucking pink ribbon.
Right.
You know, because it doesn't actually get people talking about the cause. It gets people talking about the protests themselves.
Right. And whenever I've kind of spoken out against this, because I've written a couple pieces about it, you know, I wrote a piece a couple months ago kind of going over why this is not actually protected by the First Amendment, which is just plainly it's just true of constitutional law. But then, you know, I'm sure you've heard people accuse dissenters of tone policing. I don't see this as tone policing. I see this as just like, you're being an asshole.
Yeah.
So stop.
And it's also like, it doesn't actually make people support the cause more. It doesn't.
Right.
It's having the reverse effects. It's just making people mad. It's making them late for work. And like, so in Washington state, there's a bill right now that would increase penalties for blocking traffic from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor or even a felony if public safety is endangered. And so anyone convicted could face a $5,000 penalty and 30 days in prison. What do you think about that?
I mean, I do think there should be some sort of punishment for it. And it goes back to what we were just saying.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is you are breaking the law. I'm not an anarchist. If you believe in your cause so much that you're willing to break the law, okay, maybe there's a conversation to be had there where that's a respectable choice, but you have to be willing to suffer the consequences of that,
totally.
Which
that's part of being brave. I mean, we talked about this, Jesse and I talked about this on a Primo episode in the context of this NPR reporter.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
When people were complaining about the 5-day suspension, I was like, okay, I get it. But also, if you rake your employer across the coals, a 5-day suspension is the least you can expect. But I totally 1,000% agree with you in the context of bravery, because I thought what he did was brave. And the reason it was brave is because you have to expect that maybe you're going to suffer a consequence.
Yes. And now he has actually quit his job.
Right, right, right.
So now he's brave and unemployed. But yes, that is exactly it. Like if you want to protest, this is part of protesting is taking your licks. I mean, $5,000 penalty. I doubt many of the protesters could afford to pay that. 30 days in prison, it would at least give them a warm place to sleep.
And food.
Paid and food
for by the taxpayer,
Probably not vegan and gluten-free.
No. Fewer options.
Yeah. Okay, let's do some housekeeping, and then we will get to your segment on Crowder. But first, an ad for our free listeners.
You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person, too?
That's right. That's the sound of selling everywhere, online, in-store, on social media, and beyond.
Shopify POS, no, not that POS, is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory to building relationships with customers and managing orders, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person, backed by everything you need to sell online.
With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock.
Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok, if it's still legal by the time you hear this, to Instagram and beyond.
Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone. Transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution.
Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify.
We should try this with our horrible merch store.
Oh my god, this is good. The synergy opportunity.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/barpod, all lowercase.
Go to shopify.com/barpod to take your retail business to the next level today. Please help us with our merch. Oh my god.
That's shopify.com/barpod. This is Blocked and Reported. We are a podcast. You can reach us at blockedandreportedpodcast@gmail.com with any questions, comments, cuss words, story tips. If you want to send Jesse new recipes to post online, I'm sure he will try them and he will make them look terrible no matter how good they are. You can also check us out on Reddit. We have a subreddit that is not maintained by us at all, but it is a place for interesting conversations, and that is at blockedandreported.reddit.com. We also have merch, but please don't buy it. The merch store is just an absolute disaster. There's no merch. Don't get the merch. And most importantly, if you want to support the show, you can go to blockedandreported.org, and for just $5 a month, you get 3 extra episodes of this podcast every single month. You also get your episodes early and ad-free, and you get access to our fantastic community over there of over 13,000 people and growing. It really is the best way to support the show, so please check it out at blockedandreported.org. I think that's it. I don't think I fucked anything up this time, which will be a first. All right, Billy. You've got the wheel.
Katie, today I want to talk about someone who your listeners may remember from the time he was almost sold into indentured servitude at the Daily Wire. Do you remember this, Katie?
How could I forget? Poor Steven Crowder. Yes.
Right. Yes. Yes, I'm talking about none other than the former voice actor turned attempted comedian turned conservative content creator, and that's putting it generously, Steven Crowder, who really had a moment last year when he publicly campaigned for justice after the Daily Wire offered him a paltry $50 million contract to join the company.
He is the face of the underclass. The giant head of the underclass is Steven Crowder.
He really is. The little guy. But as you and Jesse discussed last year, that partnership never happened because Steven ripped up the offer as a quote-unquote slave contract.
He is our Colin Kaepernick.
Right, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense because slaves didn't really have the freedom to enter into contracts. That was kind of like the whole point of slavery. But other than that, you can really feel for the guy, right, Katie?
He's on my prayer list.
Well, maybe you shouldn't feel bad for him because you would be shocked to know that Steven is a bit of a hypocrite here. And despite claiming to care about freedom, he too appears to support indentured servitude in the form of marriage.
You are not taking the car. Because if you refuse to do wifely things, then I will go pick up the groceries.
There's no groceries. I do have
steaks, wood pellets, my grill. I know it's an unreasonable request, but I'll go do it. How about you first? Hillary, how do you respect the man? Yes, how do you man?
Okay, so that was a snippet of Steven scolding his then partner, Hillary, on their patio several years ago when she was very pregnant with their twins. I think she was 8 months pregnant. In that clip from their Ring security footage, which we will come back to very shortly, he is irate that Hillary will not perform her, quote, wifely duties, as he said, which, as I understand from the context of the video, centered around Hillary both wanting to use the car, scandalous, women driving.
Women shouldn't drive. I always say that. I tell my wife, take the wheel. Women shouldn't drive. I need to take a nap.
And he was ordering her to feed their dogs a medication that she was reportedly worried was toxic and might harm her pregnancy. You know, silly her. So spoiler alert, they're no longer together. It's so sad. In April of 2023, a few years after that argument you just heard, but crucially before the public had actually heard it, Stephen goes on his podcast and begrudgingly announces he is getting divorced. But he presents the news in an interesting way. Take a listen.
I have been living with a proverbial boot on my neck for going on years now. Since 2021, I've been living through what has increasingly been a horrendous divorce. Now, let me say on the outset, to be clear, there is no infidelity, any kind of physical abuse at all on either side. And no, this was not my choice. My then wife decided that she didn't want to be married anymore. And in the state of Texas, that is completely permitted.
So let's skip to the end of the video.
But one thing that is undeniable in this case is that it's no one's fault but my own, in that I picked wrong.
You know, at least he really takes ownership of it. He picked wrong.
Right, right. Wow, yeah, really taking accountability. So This would kick off an internet saga that has continued the entirety of the last year. It's still going, in part because you can tell from his announcement that he, in many ways, is being far from honest. So why do so many people care about this? And why should we care about this? I think there are a few reasons. The first is that the fallout from Stephen's divorce, which has only proceeded to get more and more dramatic, has really rocked the conservative ecosphere and exposed some interesting fault lines on the right that you don't often see. Of course, there are fractures in the Republican Party and among liberals and progressives. That's not news. We've been talking about this, you know, today even. But I'm specifically talking about big fractures among the very online group of far-right political commentators who usually present a pretty united front.
Oh, good. I am so excited to get into this. Do tell.
I'm sure you are. So Steven Crowder used to be a huge presence.
I'm so sick of the blue hairs being dramatic. I want some of the crosshairs.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Steven used to be a huge presence in conservative circles. And the way he's handled this has really been kind of the biggest domino to cause his media empire to unravel pretty considerably, which is related to the next point, probably the more important one, which is that this story is also a cautionary tale about what happens when you try to fashion a brand for yourself that's in some ways completely different from who you are behind closed doors. When you try to use your influence to ruin a lot of powerless people's lives, and when you let a lust for attention on the internet rot your brain and maybe your soul. But to understand that, Katie, we have to go back to the beginning.
Okay, the Stephen Crowder Genesis story. Let's do it.
Yes, I'm talking about Stephen's original work in media, which may not be what you'd expect. Did you know that he got his start during his preteen years as a voice actor on the iconic Arthur cartoon series?
No.
Yes. Okay, so this was...
Who was he?
This was crazy to me when I learned about this because I was an absolute Arthur diehard growing up. My sister and I would without fail always watch it, and I'm almost positive that there's still a stuffed animal of DW, you know, the character in the pink dress, in my parents' house, which tells you all you need to know about me. Did you watch Arthur, Katie?
I did watch Arthur. I don't remember many specifics of it, and I think by now, like, any memories I have of Arthur have been replaced by the Arthur meme, which is just, you see this on Twitter all the time.
Right, yeah.
It's just like a picture of maybe Arthur or someone else in the show holding their fist, like angrily holding a fist.
Yes. Okay, so I'm going to try to jog your memory. There was an absolute bop on that show. I'm not sure if you remember it. I'm going to try to sing. Having fun isn't hard when you've got a library card. Does this ring a bell?
It doesn't, but that honestly sounds like something libs of TikTok would complain about.
So even though we can't be certain Stephen Crowder has ever been to a library, we can be certain he did, in fact, have a role on Arthur, where he voiced a character named The Brain, which is kind of ironic.
Yeah, that's funny.
Right, yeah. But anyway, according to IMDb, he was in some other bangers as well, including Sagwa, the Chinese Siamese Cat.
Oh, that's racist.
A Canadian drama called Three Needles.
Is that about safe injection sites?
I think that was probably before the safe injection site moment. So I need to read more about Three Needles because it sounds really intoxicating. No pun intended. And his star turn as classroom boy in a 2007 English language French thriller called The Secret. Right. But as you can tell from the career climax there, it appears that as Stephen got a little older and aged out of the tween roles,
he was no longer a cutie.
Exactly. He, for whatever reason, was struggling to find consistent work. So at the ripe old age of, I think, 17, he set his sights on stand-up comedy. Here's a clip from a routine he did at the TCon Midwest Conference a few years later in the early 2010s.
We had the CNN Tea Party coverage. I remember that when the first time it happened. Remember that lady reporter? She was talking back to Anderson Cooper. She's at the Tea Party. She's like, Anderson, I'm here at the first Tea Party gathering, but I don't really think this is family viewing. Like a guy with his kid on his shoulders behind her. She's like, this is getting out of control. He's like, miss, we're just here to protest higher taxes. She's like, I don't know if you made it. Anderson, back to you so you can tell more vulgar teabagging jokes. But she likes, you know. Oh, no. Cute little Anderson.
You know, to Steven's credit, this is Ned level comedy.
Right. Like, for some very, very odd reason that is totally beyond me, his stand-up career never really took off. Aren't you shocked, Katie?
I'm so shocked, yes.
Shocked is a tragedy.
Yeah.
So anyway, the reason I wanted to briefly go over his career arc is because it's evident that from a very young age, Steven appeared to want to be famous, or at the very least to be well known, which is helpful context for the story. But it's also important because his journey to comedy, as an extension his early internet videos, would lead him to what was arguably the most consequential step of his career, one that happens to give us a big window into how he views, or how he claims to view, marriage. And that, of course, is his stint at Fox News. So when Steven was in his early 20s, he gets a contract at Fox. A few years later, he lost that contract under kind of mysterious circumstances, which probably deserves its own episode. But thankfully for us, they didn't part ways until after he published two opinion pieces on marriage. But they weren't just about marriage. They were specifically about the importance of abstinence. What do you think about that, Katie?
Either he is a huge hypocrite or a virgin, and I'm not sure what's worse.
We might find out. In all seriousness, I think it's important for me to say here that I have a lot of respect for people who wait for marriage to have sex. I think it takes a lot of discipline and can be a good thing. But the articles from Steven are a bit odd for reasons you'll see right now. So in 2010, for Fox News Opinion, he wrote a piece called Why Not, in all caps, Why Not Having Sex Might Be Good For You. So in this piece, which was written before he got married, he opens by lamenting the relationship between sex and comedy, writing, quote, as a stand-up comedian, I've seen hacks openly depict the most depraved, explicit sexual acts they can think of just to get a laugh out of the audience. As we heard earlier, Steven is way above that with his jokes about Anderson Cooper teabagging, which if listeners don't know what that means, they can find a detailed description on Urban Dictionary. Moving on. Steven continues, quote, maybe it's just the lack of fun factor, or maybe it started with harlotry being misused as a fulcrum for women's liberation. But if you so much as suggest to someone that abstinence might be beneficial, you'll often find yourself vilified as a judgmental jackass faster than Bill Maher can throw up his dainty hands, unquote. Interestingly, in that same stand-up routine we played a snippet from earlier, which I listened to far too much of, Steven makes the same joke about Bill Maher's dainty hands. So that must have been a real classic in the arsenal. Yeah, I really cannot understand why his stand-up career didn't take off.
Does Bill Maher have dainty hands? I have never paid much attention to his hands.
I've never noticed hands that were particularly dainty. But hey, maybe I don't pay attention, as close attention as Steven does.
He keeps them under the desk so nobody can tell him.
Steven was like really like doing some detective work there.
Yeah.
So Steven goes on, quote, sure, Michelle Obama can run around the country and condemn little fatties for inhaling little Debbies. But if you try and apply that same helpful, healthful concept to sex, it's seen as pushy and or prudish, unquote. Okay, so everyone gets the idea. Mm-hmm. 2 years go by, and now Steven has entered marital bliss. So for Fox, he writes a follow-up to his first abstinence column to give the audience an update that I'm sure they were waiting for with bated breath. How he feels having waited to have sex on his wedding night.
Oh, God.
He really uses this column to push back on the naysayers who doubted him. He feels very vindicated here. He writes that people said, quote, we'd certainly never make it to the wedding without shtupping. Yes, that is the actual word he uses, shtupping.
Uh-huh.
Spelled S C-H-T-U-P-P-I-N-G, stopping. And if we did, he says, quote, and if we did, our wedding night would be awkward and terrible, they said, unquote. Okay, we need to address the most important thing first. Did you know what stopping was?
I mean, I assume that it is bumping your butts together.
Right.
I didn't know he was a Jewish grandmother.
We can use context clues to figure it out, but I definitely did not know that word was a thing until reading this piece.
Uh-huh.
And I really don't think Stephen did either, which to me shows that he probably sits down to write his sex advice columns with a thesaurus in hand, which is kind of adorable. Okay, we continue. This is when it gets really juicy. Stephen writes, quote, turns out that people couldn't have been more wrong. Looking back, I think that the women saying those things felt like the floozies they ultimately were, and the men with their fickle manhood tied to their pathetic sexual conquests felt threatened, unquote. He then goes on to detail a heart-wrenching interaction he and his new wife had with another newly married couple at an inn they were staying at post-wedding.
So they're swingers.
Stephen's... Maybe.
Don't have your... You know what? You always really need to wait until for group sex until you're married.
Exactly. That's
in the Bible.
That's the subtext of this column.
Yeah.
And Stephen surmises, based on a conversation with the other new bride, that she and her husband did not wait until marriage. My heart sank, Stephen writes. Firstly, that poor schmuck's good time is in quotes, was simply getting snookered. Snookered.
He does write like an old woman.
He's a very robust vocabulary.
Yeah.
Quote, not enjoying the company of close family and long lost friends with a clear head and clean conscience, not staring in awe at his beautiful new wife, wanting to soak in every glimmer of her eyes as she shot him heart racing looks from across the dance floor. Okay, he has watched way too many rom-coms while waiting to have sex. He was like watching, like, you know, When Harry Met Sally and like, you know, dreaming of his wedding night. I don't even know if I've seen Harry Met Sally. That's a rom-com, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Just making sure that I made a relevant cultural one. But continuing, quote, not taking all the cheesy pictures as they cut the cake, not even carrying her across the sweet threshold as they nervously anticipated their, quote, nightcap.
Oh, my God.
I think that means sex.
Is that what he calls a condom? That actually makes sense.
I feel like you are like really decoding the actual.
I speak louder.
I was taking it at face value. Okay, so again, nothing wrong with accidents. But if you do that, I think the idea should be that you're waiting out of a deep commitment, in this case to Christian values, not because you're trying to own the libs.
Or he kind of writes it as though he's edging, you know, like you just wait and wait and wait. And then you like really blow your load because you've been waiting for so fucking long.
Has anyone told you that you're kind of like a poet?
Maybe, all the
maybe
time.
Like an erotica writer.
Uh-huh.
And there's something Stephen wrote that kind of sums up this, you know, own the libs abstinence mentality for me. And it comes from the beginning of his second column. So this is after he got married, the one we were just reading from. He writes that he and his wife, quote, courted each other in a way that was consistent with our publicly professed values.
Mm-hmm.
Publicly professed values. So to see if those values were also embodied in private, where it actually matters, we will return to the near present, back to April 2023, when Stephen had long left Fox News behind and by then established himself with a successful YouTube show, Louder with Crowder, and a merch store with charming shirts that feature Che Guevara, a limp wrist, and the message, quote, socialism is for figs.
Mm-hmm.
Katie, I think we're supposed to be the figs.
Yeah, I think so. I never saw this, but I vaguely remember a Vox writer named what was his name? Carlos Maza.
Yes. So yeah, this shirt was born out of an online back and forth that I think ultimately led to Carlos Maza quitting Vox or something, but they got into a back and forth where Stephen was being very blatantly homophobic. I think he called him like a lispy queer or something like that. I don't want
to
miss.
Which, to be fair, Carlos Maza is.
But Carlos Maza, I think, you know, defined himself as a socialist at the time. So out of this confrontation, two things were born: Carlos Maza's unemployment and a shirt featuring Che Guevara. A very limp wrist. And like I said, socialism is for figs. And, you know, your listeners can use their imaginations to know what figs are supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Star between F and G.
Maybe I'll add that to our horrible merch store.
Maybe. Yeah, you were talking about your merch store.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that would be a good addition. But we should return now that we're back in the near present.
And sorry to interrupt you, but Carlos Maza, he was trying to get Steven Crowder kicked off of YouTube.
I think that was, they were arguing about content censorship. Yeah, because I think Carlos Maza was
this went very viral.
Yeah, he was arguing that it was too homophobic.
Right. I remember I was at The Stranger when this happened, and I wrote a column defending Crowder, not defending his work, but saying like he shouldn't be kicked off of YouTube for.
Oh, it's comedy. Yeah, and I would agree with that too.
Yeah, it's not funny, but it's an attempt at comedy. He shouldn't be kicked off of YouTube.
I actually would like to know, as I was, researching for our conversation, I came across the Carlos exchange and I could not figure out what happened to him. So he went to YouTube and did his own channel, but he has essentially since then kind of disappeared. Yeah. And I want.
Well, yeah. I mean, the other funny thing about him is that he was I think he was beyond a socialist. He was a Marxist, and it turned out that he was from a very wealthy family. So presumably,
so he may have been canceled by his own.
Yeah,
I was assuming maybe he was doing corporate communications or working for the DSA or something.
Yeah, probably doing corporate communications for Raytheon or something, or maybe he's just working for the family business. Yeah, that was part of it. Was that Carlos? It turns out was his family's loaded.
Okay, well that makes sense as to why he faded into obscurity.
Yeah.
Well, we're still dealing with Steven Crowder, lucky us. Mm-hmm. So that brings us to the near present, to the release of that Ring security footage. So as we discussed earlier, Steven announces his divorce in April of last year, taking the blame because he, quote, picked wrong, but essentially casting Hillary as one of the floozies he wrote about in his previous columns, his words, not mine, who just didn't have respect for marriage and commitment.
Well, maybe he picked wrong because he didn't try the goods first. You got a sample.
Right, right. Stunningly, he has not come to that conclusion. Maybe he's almost there. Do you think?
Maybe.
So he released that announcement on April 25th, so almost exactly a year ago to our conversation right now. 2 days later, on the 27th, Hillary leaks that security video showing Steven berating her at their home. And she leaks it to a guy named Yashar Ali, who I'm not quite I'm not quite sure what he does for a living other than posting social media all day. You know, one of life's great mysteries.
He's a recurring character on this podcast.
Right. I tweet so much that I don't understand how he would have a job if he does have a job.
He's like Ian Miles Cheong of the left in terms of how often he tweets. Not as obnoxious, although he did get Allison. He was instrumental to getting Allison Roman canceled because he unearthed some photos of her dressed like Amy Winehouse in Halloween in the 90s or the early 2000s.
That made me so mad.
Yeah. And then he said she was dressed like a chola. She ended up losing her column at New York Times over that and some bullshit she said about some she insulted two extremely powerful women, Chrissy Teigen and Marie Kondo.
And did you, speaking of cancellations, ironically, did you read the LA Magazine article on Yashar Ali? Right. So I was living in LA when that came out.
Was he living in your basement?
He might have been, because basically the takeaway from that article was that he basically just breaks into people, rich people. I'm not rich, but he breaks into rich people's houses, right? And just kind of squats. He's the original squatter.
Yeah.
Squatter's right. Squatter's right.
And then he said he was suicidal and he disappeared for a long time. And then
for a year, a full year. And then randomly just started posting again and has resumed.
Started posting nothing had happened. And honestly.
Right. Exactly.
Props to him. That is the way to handle it. I sort of like him. At least I like him a lot better than I do Ian Miles Cheong.
Oh, 1,000%.
I think he's more reliable. I think he's done some dumb cancel culture stories. I don't like all of his takes, but I feel sort of bad for him.
I agree.
Yeah.
And I actually like him. I don't know if this is some weird psychological warfare, but I like him more since he's come back. I don't know what he did in that, because it was probably a solid year, right, where he just didn't post, and then he randomly just starts posting again all day every day, and he seems more mild in some way. I don't know.
I don't think he's trying to get people canceled anymore. To me, that's the big difference.
I think because he understands what that feels like.
Right. I mean, maybe he's making money from Twitter, from Elon's paychecks, but I kind of doubt it, because Elon seems to handpick the people and the amounts that get paid, and Yashar Ali would for sure not fit on his preferred list, I don't think.
Definitely not. All that to say, Yashar still has a very sizable following, and so when he posts this Ring footage last year, it totally blows up, in part because it wildly contradicts Stephen's self-serving explanation in some pretty shocking ways. Let's listen to a little more.
You're going to take the car and leave me here. Hillary, just think of how boxed in you've made me.
What do you need me to pick up? I'll get it. I'll be back when I'm back.
No, that doesn't work either. You'll be back when you're back. That doesn't work either.
See,
do you understand the difference between my life being set to the second and you going, I'll be back when I'm back?
Stephen.
The only way out of this is discipline and respect. It's the only way out of it, or we're at an impact.
We are at an impasse.
Good. Because you can't have any discipline or respect.
Yeah.
There you go. You throw your hand. You give up so easily.
I don't give up, Stephen.
You know, Stephen? You give up so easily. I just said the only way out of this is discipline or respect. And you said, then we're at an impasse.
Stephen, no, we are at an impasse, okay? I love you, but Stephen, your abuse is sick. Your abuse is sick.
Watch it. Fucking watch it.
I'm gonna let go. I'll get what you need to get. And I need some space. We need to just have a baby.
Oh, man. She's way too patient with him.
Right, right. So this is painful to listen to. And you can already see that Stephen's tale of victimhood that he's presenting publicly is not exactly accurate. And we've only listened to about half the footage. But remember that question we were pondering earlier about whether or not Stephen's publicly professed values, which he used to build his career in media, were actually legit. So to get an even better feel for that, let's listen to another part of his divorce announcement.
It's pretty simple. I loved a woman so much that I married her. A woman who, despite all of this, I still love as the mother of my children.
And back to the security footage.
Okay, I love you. I love you very much.
I don't love you. That's the big problem.
Well, I guess that clears that up.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, so I followed all of this when it happened. And there are, of course, moments in people's marriages that in any relationship that like people say nasty shit to each other. I would never personally, but I'm sure that this happens in other people's relationships. And so part of me at the time was like, can we really take, you know, this one clip and assume that's representative of the whole marriage? And I think in this case, probably yes.
Right. And I think that's the reason why this story is interesting, is because the fallout, as we'll continue to get into over the course of this conversation, the fallout from his divorce is actually about a lot more than his divorce, which we will see in some of those fractures on the online right, which we're going to talk about now. So interestingly, you know, during his divorce announcement, Stephen hinted at some of that fracturing. He said, you know, his breakup was already triggering some of those divisions behind the scenes before the divorce was even public. And this is in some sense why his beef with the Daily Wire's quote slave contract is relevant to the discussion of his divorce. So in January 2023, after he has that big dust up with Daily Wire management, none other than Candace Owens, the recently ousted queen mother of the Daily Wire, goes on her show and cryptically makes a swipe at Stephen. Let's listen.
Stephen has a lot going on, I guess is the best way to say it. He has a lot going on, and that should be clear because people don't do stuff like this if there's not a lot going on in their lives. I would like to implore my audience and everybody that isn't paying attention to this situation not to condemn him, but to pray for him. Sometimes people need a prayer. Sometimes people need a scripture. You know, Stephen purports to be a Christian. I am unsure at this moment if it is my place to say more than that. You know, maybe if I feel in further defense, something should be said, or maybe if I feel that the public has a right to understand certain circumstances.
So Stephen plays this on a show during his announcement, and he essentially says that his pending divorce has been somewhat of an open secret among parts of the online right, with people allegedly threatening to use it against him. So directly after he aired that Candace clip, this is what he had to say about some of his fellow travelers holding his divorce over his head.
Now, some other issues have been, inferences have been more pernicious behind the scenes with demands and threats to use this information that they believe would be so publicly embarrassing to me and my wife at a difficult time that it could be used, knowingly putting my children in harm's way. So, to those self-styled Christians, conservatives, and allies, well, not in my book.
So I have to say, it is pretty hilarious to me that Candace, I say Crisis King to own the Jews, Owens, and Stephen, I tell my wife I don't love her, Crowder, are publicly and righteously
legal names
on the birth certificate, are publicly and righteously lecturing people in this exchange about, you know, yeah, how to be a good Christian. Which
didn't Jesus say something about how it's harder for a rich man to get into heaven than the
he did
something camel through an eye of something,
right?
Something?
That is in the Gospels, right?
Yeah.
It's a pretty, I think this exchange is a pretty fitting look at the type of Christianity that is sometimes most visible in these really online far-right circles, where true to the question of publicly stated values versus actually living those values, it sometimes appears to be less a genuine profession of faith and more of a tool to not only own the libs, but also here to own the fellow cons. Isn't that something, Katie?
Yeah. I mean, hypocrisy, long in story tradition and for public Christians, as far as I can tell.
I don't think you're wrong.
It's interesting to me that that divorce at this day and age, when divorce is so common, that divorce is still seen as taboo in this ecosystem.
Right. I mean, you even see some people, this is like kind of tangentially related to this story, but you even see some people railing against no-fault divorce today and arguing in these kind of really niche circles. I mean, I don't think that's ever going to happen, but some people are actually making the argument that no-fault, that you should like legally not be permitted to divorce, I guess, what is the irreconcilable differences, like basically for if you don't have a display of abuse that you can show.
Right. I've seen right-wingers and trads online say things like, a woman should have no right to divorce a man, even if he's abusive to her. And then you say, what if she cheats on him? And it's like, oh, well, in that case, that obviously.
And also the fascinating part about people bringing up no-fault divorce in the context of Steven Crowder is
there's a fault,
you know, as you can hear on the right. Like, I wouldn't, you know, but Katie, his fault was picking wrong.
Oh, right.
You know?
Right.
So that was really the only fault. Anyway, you can tell that someone's actually at fault. So it's not even really relevant. But anyway, after Hillary releases the security video courtesy of Yashar, her family also attaches a statement, and that, you know, Yashar publishes this on his Substack, that reads in part, quote, "The truth is that Hillary spent years hiding Stephen's mentally and emotionally abusive behavior from her friends and family while she attempted to save their marriage. She was the one who was asking to work on their relationship to keep the marriage intact for their unborn children," unquote. But they also dropped another bomb. They wrote, quote, "Hillary urged Stephen to get the help he needed to address his abuse with the hope that their marriage could be saved and they could peacefully live together as a family. Instead, Stephen refused to do so and chose not to be with his wife during the birth of their children." They go on to say, "After the birth, Stephen bought a townhouse and left their home permanently. Hillary was unaware that Stephen had hired a divorce attorney and asked his assistant to cut Hillary off financially. There is significant documentation substantiating these facts." So while it's true that Hillary, this is Billy speaking now, not Hillary's family. So while it's true that Hillary did file for divorce in December 2021, the petitions show that, according to her family, she only did so after it became clear that Stephen was allegedly pondering that exact same thing and trying to leave her financially destitute, which means her spiel about this, quote, "not being my choice" was allegedly all for his audience. Shocking. So as you might expect, the whole thing, but especially that security footage, went super viral. And a lot of people are like, Stephen, are you totally full of shit? And so the next day, he goes back on his show, Louder with Crowder, and tries to do some damage control. In it, he accuses Hillary of misleadingly editing the video, which your listeners can decide for themselves if that's remotely plausible, and says, quote, "I have filed a motion to officially unseal all files as they relate to the matter of legal record. Finances, relevant medical records, including mental health history or evaluation." So it sounds like he was basically threatening to like release her medical history to the public, which is probably illegal. "Depositions and any motions or sanctions from the courts of Texas, I will not," in caps, "be leaking," part of this came in the form of a Twitter statement, Twitter X, whatever, "I will not be leaking private marital information to the press, but if the privacy agreements are not respected by all parties, I will address all that as a matter of irrefutable legal record in full context next week," unquote. That might have been another bluff, because to my knowledge, he never did address that, quote, "irrefutable legal record," and that post has since been deleted. But it is archived because the internet never dies. So as I alluded to at the top of the show, these few days blew up in Stephen's face. And they were really the big domino that sent his business into a spiral. So on May 2nd, a week after Stephen made his first error-laden divorce announcement, the New York Post, which most people probably know is no one's idea of a liberal publication, publishes an expose outlining allegations from 10 former staffers who claimed Crowder ran a, quote, abusive operation where he, quote, screamed at his employees, including his own father, exposed his genitals, sent out directives to arbitrarily fire people, and made underlings wash his dirty laundry. Charming. Do you have your staffers wash your dirty laundry, Katie?
Jesse, but I don't let him do the panties.
Do you do that yourself?
I just get new ones every day.
Wow, throw them out. Sounds expensive. The Post also noted that the vast majority of the people that the reporter interviewed left voluntarily. They were not fired. And that they were nervous to speak out because they feared Stephen would lash out against them or because he had made some of them sign NDAs, as any good crooked boss knows to do. Also,
Jesse, sign yours.
Oh my gosh. Also of note is that in a moment of foreshadowing on April 20th, similar to the, you know, the Candace Owens veiled swipe, just a few days before Stephen announces his divorce, his former co-host Dave Landau, who's a host on The Blaze, who I actually just saw perform stand-up like a few weeks ago, funny guy, he went on Michael Malice's podcast and described Stephen as a, quote, bully who is extremely controlling and often driven by jealousy. Interesting. So because it's only fair to give Stephen an opportunity to comment on these allegations, this is what he had to say on his show about some of those accusations when he was chatting with a couple of his colleagues, including his CEO, Gerald Morgan. Let's listen.
Now there's this newspaper article out this morning where it says, quote, Crowder was known to expose his genitals to staffers.
Well, hold on a second. Yes.
Yeah, well,
yes.
Just wait. I mean,
that did happen. I mean, what are you talking about? The Terminator 2 sketch?
No, but at the time, he only had 5 employees and they were all male.
Okay, I love his CEO's implication that it's physically impossible or something for Steven Crowder to expose himself to employees simply because they were male. You're almost there, Gerald. You're so close.
Look, if men have it themselves, so it's just like looking at their own, it doesn't count, something, something, something.
Exactly, exactly. Nothing, no misconduct, you know, it's just totally, totally fine. So over the summer, it comes out that Steven is pushing for full custody of his kids, which is not a great look. Meanwhile, these accusations of workplace misconduct and general assholery keep growing until they reach a climax. And this basically brings us to today, when we really start to see those fractures on the very online right coming to the forefront, right out in the open. And that is in some sense embodied by the trials and tribulations of Not Gay Jared. Katie, are you familiar with Not Gay Jared?
I'm not. Is this a cousin to Subway Jared?
Oh my gosh. No,
he was not pedo Jared.
No, yeah, that guy's in federal prison. Do you ever call yourself gay, Katie?
I don't, but I should.
So Not Gay Jared is Jared Monroe, a former producer on Louder with Crowder. And as I understand it, he really became a popular figure with a lot of Stephen's audience because he would often appear on camera as a co-host in addition to his producing duties. But he quit in 2018, and the circumstances around why were always pretty mysterious. You know, you can Google his name and, you know, all those random sites that are like, what happened to Jared? Right. What happened? So no one had the answer. Well, it's not a mystery anymore because it turns out he disappeared because he was one of the many employees who was pressured into signing an NDA. But to the surprise of many, he spoke out just a few weeks ago anyway on video. Let's listen.
I signed this separation agreement, an NDA containing a strict and very broad non-disparagement clause many years ago. I voluntarily left my job after deciding I could no longer put myself or my growing family through the toxic and abusive work environment I had endured for years. This place was and is to this day a workplace rife with sexual misconduct, degeneracy, and aggression. The things I saw, the things done to me, and the things I witnessed my employer do to others were disgusting, shocking, and utterly indefensible. I have the receipts. This all took a serious toll on my personal health.
So he definitely saw his balls.
I think at a minimum.
Yeah.
Probably more. So he goes on to say that seeing, you know, whatever he saw, maybe the balls, maybe more, ultimately led him to being admitted to the hospital, where he was treated for what sounds like severe anxiety as a result of working with Steven. But the reason this is coming up again is that Jared said he recently received a cease and desist letter from, quote, his former employer, which he doesn't actually name because of the NDA, but we can reasonably assume this is Steven Crowder, who is threatening to sue if he does not, quote, cease communication with his friends, quote. Jared's friends, yeah. Steven is also allegedly threatening to have Jared deposed to testify, but Jared doesn't seem to be deterred anymore. Let's listen again.
Free speech matters. Matters a lot to me, and that's not just a t-shirt slogan. It really matters. And these kinds of NDAs right here, stemming from this, are unquestionably unconstitutional. I will not live with the burden of this unconstitutional NDA over my head for the rest of my life, especially when information I have can be used to aid other victims escape their own abusive situations, which is the context for which this former employer feels they caught me breaking my agreement.
Is he right about this, that it is unconstitutional to make someone to sign an NDA, as our legal expert?
So there's a debate about this. Yeah, there's a debate about this. I mean, obviously NDAs are entered into as, you know, private agreements. I think some people would say with some of the financial incentives that cross a line, but
it's coercion.
Right.
Yeah. Have you ever signed one?
I have not. Have you?
Can you tell me? I've signed non-disparagements after
stranger,
after getting laid off from it. No, not stranger. At my previous employer before then, Grist.
Well, maybe you can. Is an NDA ever offered if the employer doesn't have something to hide? Like, what is otherwise the motivation?
They actually didn't have it. I mean, it wasn't like a particularly fun place to work, but there was nothing scandalous. There was a small scandal that I guess I can't discuss because I signed the NDA. But by the time I left, the people involved had left. I don't know why. I think it's just kind of boilerplate. And media organizations know that the people that they hire are messy and like to talk a lot. So maybe it's just a precaution.
Right.
But at the same time, this was sort of held over my head. Like, you sign the NDA and you get severance, you get 2 weeks pay, or you don't, and you don't get shit.
Two weeks. Right. Oh my gosh. Well, at this point in the Crowder saga, you can see that the personal and the professional are really coming together here. And the saga surrounding Steven's divorce and the way he's treated his wife behind closed doors is colliding quite dramatically with how he's treated his employees behind closed doors. So it sounds like when the doors are closed, he's not a great guy. And he's also not really a great guy on camera either, but he tries to be better, I guess, or at least more righteous.
I'm so shocked that the guy who makes a living calling people fags
calling people fags while lecturing people on how to be a good Christian.
Right, totally.
And talking about how much he loves his wife while going on their patio and saying, I don't love you.
Right.
So a couple of weeks ago, Jared announces on X, formerly Twitter, whatever you want to call it, that his, quote, former employer, again, we know this is Steven Crowder, is suing him for the low, low price of $1 million. Mm. Katie, if $50 million was a slave contract, what do you think that is?
I guess he's an indentured servant. does Jared still work, or is he just like totally disappeared from public life?
He does still work, but he goes into that in his video about how it was very hard for him to work in media again because they were essentially coming at him and trying to make it so he would have to adhere to a non-compete, even though he claims he never agreed to that. And so that's actually one of the big reasons he has kind of resurfaced, is because he is asking for legal help because he has three children, and, you know, Steven Crowder is so wealthy that he can afford to file frivolous claims against people. And he has to defend himself somehow. And so to do that, you will never guess who Not Gay Jared hired as his attorney to file a lawsuit against Lauterworth Crowder with the National Labor Relations Board. Any guesses?
Who is it?
It is none other than Matt Brunig.
Oh my
far
God.
Left, right, the far left lawyer and blogger who is essentially a socialist. I know a lot of people bastardize that word, but he's like actually a socialist, which makes his partnership with Not Gay Jared quite the interesting one.
That's really interesting. So Matt, I don't know how much like law he's actually practiced. He was much more of a blogger. rather than a lawyer, but he has popped up recently because he's also suing like the ACLU.
Oh, interesting.
On some labor issue. Yeah, the ACLU.
So he's like really like making his law debut. Because yes. I agree. I had also just associated him with blogging and like think tanking.
Yeah, and like arguing with people online.
Right, on Twitter.
Yeah. So it's a really interesting case. I don't know all the details, but the ACLU fired an employee. I think she was an Asian woman. And said that she was fired because they accused her of being racist because her bosses were black. And she said that she was like scared of her bosses and she called them angry or something.
No.
And so
the angry
they said
black
that this
yeah,
was
okay.
like racist. Right. That she like it was a trope that she was scared of her bosses.
Wow.
And so he's suing that.
Well, here he is.
Which is great.
So the formation of that odd couple. Sorry, not gay Jared. I'm not trying to offend. Just a turn of phrase. Is coinciding with people on the very online right taking their battle stances here. And it has essentially become a litmus test for who is still somewhat sane and who may have a soul with people we might want to load onto a rocket ship and blast off into the sun. Who do you want to hear from first, Katie?
Oh my God, chef's choice. You go.
So let's start with the people remaining on planet Earth. So Ben Shapiro over at the Daily Wire reportedly donated $500 to Jared's legal fund a few weeks ago.
Generous.
Right. Mike Cernovich last year, of Pizzagate fame, last year noted that Stephen brought a lot of this on himself by blaming Hillary in a, quote, crybaby victim video.
Uh-huh.
And in a more recent reference to the Jared conflict, noted that Crowder was, quote, being a dick, which, quote, works until it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Then Lauren Southern in March, just a few weeks back, defended the fact that Stephen has to fund Hillary in legal proceedings, saying that Stephen, quote, went for full custody of the kids, in caps, but thankfully she was awarded some funds to prevent herself, from becoming homeless and having her children taken. She also noted that Stephen, quote, asked Hillary to quit her job and move to Texas to support his career because she actively supported the creation of his wealth at his request. And that was in an exchange with Tim Pool, whom she asked, do you not think being a stay-at-home wife is an important job?
Okay, if this crowd of people, Ben Shapiro, Mike Cernovich, Lauren Southern, if they're lecturing you on your ethics, you have done something very wrong. And they're correct in this case.
Right. I totally agree. And that's why the fracturing in this, kerfuffle is so interesting to me, because these people are usually kind of just like united in their craziness. But you see like a real division here between like, okay, you're usually crazy, but like actually you're making a lot of sense here.
Yeah. I would say, I don't know about Lauren Southern, but Mike Cernovich and Ben Shapiro are actually really our family men.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's going to bring us not only to the pro Stevens, but also to the niche cultural debates that Stevens' divorce has spurred in these very online conservative circles. You kind of heard it in Lauren Southern's bit with Tim Pool, not only concerning, you know, the morality of divorce, which Stephen has made very clear he opposes. And he does not believe in no fault divorce. And of course, he's committed no faults at all. But it's also
rather than choosing wrong.
He picked wrong. But it's also spurred some debates about gender dynamics generally in relationships.
Oh, God.
So since we were just – right. That's a scary proposition. So since we were just on Tim Pool, let's go to him. He has been firmly in Stephen's camp. In late March, Tim, legal expert that he is, posted the wild claim that Stephen was being forced to pay Hillary $25,000 in child support, which, quote, his ex-wife uses to pay lawyers to go after him. He has to fund his own destruction, which, unquote, which Tim said was, quote, too communist for him. I love that, like, just anytime someone on the right now, like, doesn't like something, like, that's communist, right? That word doesn't...
It's a very James Lindsay move.
Right. Communism, like, does have a meaning. Like, the word has a meaning, but I'm not really sure if anyone knows what it means anymore.
It's the equivalent of lefties who call everything a Nazi. Everybody a Nazi or everything fascism. Yeah.
Absolutely. But the claim Tim made about the $25,000 is a very interesting one, most notably because it's totally legally illiterate. The money that Stephen has to pay Hillary is not child support. It's just until their divorce is finalized. And the only reason he has to pay it is because Stephen, as a millionaire, keeps bringing these frivolous claims in court against Hillary. Very out of character, I know. He's never done anything like that. And the law requires, you know, in Texas, hardly a liberal
right.
bastion. The law requires that she be able to defend herself in those appeals against, like I said, someone who has the money to hire, you know, endless lawyers to file yeah. endless claims. The law requires that she be able to defend herself, especially since he is literally trying to take their kids.
Why does he even want the kids? Just as a fuck you to her, probably.
I honestly think, based on the, you know, character arc we've seen from him, I'm sure, I mean, I would like to believe he loves his kids, but also at the same time, I do think part of the reason he's, like, letting these, you know, lawsuits rain down, these claims rain down on her, is, I think he wants to win.
Yeah.
I think yeah. I think he wants to beat her.
Yeah.
And what better, you know, what more consequential thing to take from someone than their kids? As for Jared, Tim also has some strong thoughts, and this is what he had to say about him on his show.
I gotta say, I feel a little male bias forming. This idea that you would, as a former employee, interfere in the custody of a father and his kids. Now, for all we know, there's reason why people would be like, Crowder shouldn't be near his kids, I guess. But pending any legitimate evidence or claims or public presented anything, I think it is disgusting. And, you know, I default instantly to the Steven Crowder is the father, and you should not, as a third party, a year after they've initiated this divorce strategy, interfere. I find that despicable.
Okay, what that fails to account for, of course, is that Jared is trying to present evidence and claims, but can't because Steven has threatened to sue him into the ground. Tim Pool, mm-hmm. always sticking up for the little guy, always on the side of justice.
We should at some point, unfortunately, we'll probably have to do a 7-part series on the political evolution of Tim Pool. The only thing that stays consistent about that man is his beanie.
I 1000% agree. I would listen to that series. I'm like first in line to subscribe. I was thinking about that as I was listening to his videos about Steven Crowder, because I remember him when he still claimed to be vaguely leftist, but now he just takes the most yeah. reactionary, you know, I have no problem with conservatives. People, you know, as someone who subscribes to libertarianism, I have some views that some people would characterize as conservative. I have friends on all sides of the debate, but I just feel like he kind of pivoted to this really reactionary conservative yeah. stance, and it just keeps drifting farther right because it's just so shocking and gets him more attention. I mean, I would genuinely like to know what he believes, because I don't think any, like, do you know?
I don't know. I think he and Dave Rubin strike me as very similar in that way.
Absolutely. 1000%.
They're like very opportunistic. Maybe they're true believers. Maybe.
No way. I mean,
or maybe they just follow the winds. Right. Right. And the winds, by winds, I mean
right.
money.
And I followed, right. Exactly. It was like they saw an opening in the market for reactionary right-leaning voices. I mean,
like,
and you
the ex-liberal, yeah.
Right, exactly. And that was very trendy in the time that both of them mm-hmm. really came to prominence. It was actually really interesting watching Dave Rubin, because he, for a time, after leaving the Young Turks, used the same label that I prefer, which is classical liberal. And that's like a very niche term that, you know, when you say it, most normie people who don't live on the internet, you need to explain to them, you know, oh, that's the liberalism line of the founders, whatever. So to me, I was like, okay, maybe he's actually committed to this. But then you watch his interviews, and there's, you know, a pretty notorious Joe Rogan interview where Joe Rogan, whose ideology also confuses me, but he really presses Dave Rubin on why he believes what he believes, and he just cannot explain it. And I think it goes back to, you know, our conversation at the top of the episode about how policy is just not in vogue anymore, like actually sitting down to be like, what policies best help people, because what travels on the internet is owning the libs and owning the cons, and you kind of have to pick. Right, it's the culture war stuff.
Right, it's culture war shit. It's common enemy thinking, where you decide you treat politics like team sports, and you root for the team that your enemies hate. It's very silly. It's very superficial.
Exactly, and the topics that get people riled on both the left and the right, you know, it's not like, you know, even, you know, people who say like they care about criminal justice reform or whatever, it's always like the most simplified version. I guess I'm more referring to mm-hmm. the left in that vein. Or, you know, on the right, when we're talking about trans people, there are actual debates to be had about policy, you know, over like women's sports, that kind of thing. But it's the libs of TikTok style, right? It's like, let's just do the lowest common denominator. Did you see that video of the of Chaya Raichik who was asked to explain what woke is and she couldn't do it?
I have not seen it, but I can imagine the stammering.
Right. Right. But it's like, I mean, this is like the one thing you claim to care about, which is culture warring, and you can't even get to the core of it.
And I'll say it is a hard word to define, but it's not that hard. I mean, I can do it right now. It's a set of dogmas, contemporary dogmas, based on the principles of social justice, anti-racism, anti-capitalism. Values do not include free speech.
An obsession with identity and intersectionality. Right. Right, exactly.
Yeah, we just did it.
Right, and who was most oppressed.
Right.
Yeah, we really did. And if that is like your only thing that you claim to care about, you think you would at least know what it means. I mean, another thing, like, you know, another Chaya Raichik-ism recently was when she posted about the Baltimore Bridge collapse, and it was a picture of Pete Buttigieg, the transportation secretary, on a swing with his husband, and it was something like, oh, wow, guys, I feel really great about the Baltimore Bridge collapse. And this was just like an out of context photo. And to me, that just it's like the epitome of like you have no intellectual horsepower to back up your positions. I think everyone's entitled to their views, including people who oppose gay marriage, whatever. That's everyone is entitled to their views. I believe that very deeply. And I think that is important to the American project, even if I disagree with those views. But you also should be able to like make intellectual arguments, which so many of these people cannot do.
Chaya is a poster. That is it. She is good at posting.
Right. She is a poster.
She is inarticulate. She doesn't understand policy.
And I would just love the right to nominate someone in their movement to like really lead the way who can articulate a cogent and thoughtful policy vision. But this conversation about culture warriors is a perfect segue into the next pro Steven character. You know, what would a story like this be without Pearl Davis, the 27-year-old internet provocateur who believes every woman past the age of 18 is the equivalent of rotten, chunky milk. Right. Every woman gets 1 year and that's it. And by 19, she's toast, which I don't know what that makes Pearl because she's 27 and unmarried, I believe.
I like age milk. Age milk is cheese. Everyone loves cheese.
Yeah, cheese is basically mold. Exactly.
Right.
So in all seriousness, I kind of even hate that we have to acknowledge this person because she's so fundamentally, you know, unserious and solely out for attention. But I think it's important to highlight it here because it really is an apt look into the strength of the pro Steven argument and the mental gymnastics you really have to go through to land where some of these people have landed.
Yeah. And Pearl, for people who don't know, she's a trad, so that stands for traditionalist, I suppose. And her whole thing is about, she's basically like a female anti-feminist, but not in like the Camille Paglia tradition. She's a moron.
Right, exactly. And she takes the, you know, the cheapest swings. Like she has actually said, you know, the 18-year-old thing was a joke, but she has made it clear that I think it's around 25. She thinks that if you're not married by 25, you've expired. And a lot of people have been like, you're literally 27 and unmarried. Like, what does that mean for you? But she's basically appealing. I would say, I think you probably agree, she is appealing to an audience of incels. And I think that word is overused, but I think she really does. Like, she's going for the Reddit audience of men who feel entitled to sex but never got it, and she's kind of like stoking their anger. So that is a good backdrop to start listening to her commentary on Steven Crowder. So here's Pearl on her show responding to some of that footage.
Okay, maybe none of you guys have been in a fight. Maybe. This just seems like a fight. But I just thought it was weird the way she had her belly out. It just looked like she was acting to me.
Like her very pregnant belly.
So this security footage, yes, you can tell that Hillary Crowder is very pregnant. I believe it was 8 months pregnant. So I would like to remind you that when you do get to be 8 months pregnant, which I, as a male, have never experienced, but I do know enough.
Oh, come on. Some men can get pregnant, Billy.
Right. I need to be PC here. Some men can, but I can't. And I would like to remind listeners that at 8 months pregnant, you don't really have to push your stomach out because it's just out. And she was pregnant with twins. 8 months pregnant with twins, you're like a sumo wrestler at that point.
There's watermelons in there.
Right. And so that was her first foray. Here's Pearl commenting on the footage after Stephen tells his wife he doesn't love her.
You need me dead. And I need some space. We need to just stop engaging for a little bit, okay? I love you. I love you very much.
I don't love you. That's the big problem. I've never received love from you. And
now, I know on paper, if you're not super red-pilled, right, men receive love through respect. So he's saying here, again, I just want you to listen to me. That's what he's communicating. Women and men don't receive love in the same way, okay?
Just like making excuses for him.
Right. Pearl Davis, relationship coach. I love how she just says, she chalks right. this up to women and men receiving love in different ways. I guess men receive love in like worship, and women receive love in like, yeah. I don't know, being, you know, abused. Right, exactly.
The thing you don't understand, Billy, is that Steven Crowder's love language is telling his wife he doesn't love her.
Right.
He's just nagging her.
Right, and yeah. he's just nagging her. That's the way women receive love. That's the way men give love. Therapy culture.
Yes.
So there you have it. That is the story of the rise and fall of Steven Crowder.
Do you think this is going to have any effect on his career?
Yeah, so when I say the rise and fall, as I'm saying fall, it does seem like an overstatement. The reason, though, that I think it is accurate is because before this happened, you know, he was always very reactionary and popular with kind of like the more extreme voices.
Mm-hmm.
But like, he really has lost a lot of support. And you can see that in the fact that, you know, someone like Lauren Southern, who's literally described as alt-right, she doesn't even want to indulge him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that he will always be able to make a living with his show, which I think he's moved to Rumble, you know, the more conservative.
He can sell his mugs.
Right. He can sell his mug club, he calls it. He can sell his, you know, homophobic Che Guevara t-shirts. I do think there will always be an audience for that, but I think he shot himself in the foot, and I think he probably has seen a drastic reduction in at least the people who want to engage with him, because even some of the fringiest people are like, that's too fringe for me,
yeah.
which is really saying something. Like, you have to really work to get that low.
He really should have taken that contract with the Daily Wire. Then they might have been on his side.
Right, and that's why I opened with that. It's so fascinating to think of, because the divorce was like the second domino, but the first mm-hmm. domino, you know, per the Candace Owens episode, was him going on and like, you know, calling this enormously, you know, beneficial contract to him that, I mean, I read part of it had not only the $50 million, but 4 weeks annual paid vacation, a full staff, editorial control. Like, it was like a content creator's dream contract.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine like what goes on in his head. I think it is a window into his particular view of insanity that he thinks that that was like insulting.
Yeah.
You know? And so yeah. I think a lot of people, you know, in that really, you know, online right world, that was kind of the first moment where they were like, what are you smoking? Well, like, what is going on in your head? Where mm-hmm. like, this is even a conclusion you could draw. And I think it's also insulting because I'm sure you know that the right is kind of trying to refashion itself as the party of the working class now.
Right.
And in some sense, they've done it successful. I mean, like, you know, the party of George W. Bush was more, you know, whether or not they wanted it to be. Yeah. Perceived, right, it was perceived as the party of the rich and corporations.
Business,
and, you know, right, exactly. And the modern right, the Trumpian right, for all its culture war stuff, has tried, you know, if it does have any policy focus, to be about populism and the mm-hmm. little guy and helping like manufacturing people. And I just think if he has courted, you know, he must have courted an audience that at least consists in part of those people. And I think that's the reason, or at least part of the reason, why that first dust up was really consequential and people kind of not taking him seriously anymore. Because, I mean, if you're trying to get like the working guy, they're not going to understand why you are upset over a $50 million contract over 4 years. What is it, like $12 million a year? That's insane. I mean, like...
True. Although then again, the fact that the head of the populist movement is Donald Trump means there's probably not a lot of ideological consistency when it comes to who the idols are.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's so funny to hear him talk about people like Donald Trump talk about the little guy. Because, yeah, you're totally right. I mean...
Yeah.
Obviously a very rich person who somehow finds a way to lose more money than he earns and still stays rich. I don't really get it, but, you know, that's the American dream, right?
Yeah, con artists are good at that. Billy, well, thank you for this. I think best case scenario, I'm looking at a picture of Steven Crowder right now, and he looks remarkably like the gay actor Billy Eichner.
He really does.
He really does. I think Billy writes a movie about this where the Steven Crowder character, it turns out that he's just an asshole because he's a giant fig himself. He's been in the closet and he'll be played by Billy Eichner.
Okay, so two things before I go. I hope that when that movie is made, we have cameos for this episode.
Absolutely.
Right, that were characters in the movie. And I also do want to say before we finish that I know we're making light of this, you have to laugh so you don't cry. But these are serious things. And, you know, I'm really wishing Hillary the best. She posted on Twitter the other day that she's looking for work and that
I
she had planned on, right, she had planned on being a stay-at-home mom. That was always the agreement she had was, I think that Stephen really wanted her to be a stay-at-home mom or probably forced her into it in some way, or may have been a requirement of marriage. Mm-hmm. But now she has to find work and find a way to support herself. And Jared in his video also talked about how he's under a lot of financial duress right now because of the lawsuit that Stephen has filed against him. And, you know, both of these people have children and, you know, I'm really wishing them the best that they come out of this in one piece. And I'm wishing the best for Stephen too. And that hopefully one day he will learn not to be such an insufferable asshole.
Yeah, I don't hope the best for him, but the other two, yes. Good luck. All right. Thank you, Billy, so much. Good to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
You can check out Billy's writing at reason.com or check him out on Twitter at Billy Binion. This has been Blocked and Reported. Our show is produced, as always, with help from Tracing Woodgrains and Jessica, the 80s baby. I'm Katie Herzog, and we'll be back next week with a new guest host.